It was the Wild West. Still is. I picked it up at a truck stop for $25, plus ammo. Thus began my illicit relationship with that venerable firm. I'm not on their books. Quite a few of the guys we were travelling with were carrying shooters. They were fucking hard cats who I worked with. I remember that other side of it. Pools of blood oozing out of dressing rooms and realising there's a beating going on and you don't want to get involved. But the biggest horror of all was seeing the cops turn up, especially backstage. You should have seen some of the band run, baby. A lot of cats on the road were on the run for one reason or another, probably minor offences like not paying their alimony or auto theft. You were not working with saints here. They were good players and they could pick up a gig and disappear amongst the minstrels. They were streetwise like motherfucker. Backstage, a squad of cops would arrive with a warrant for somebody who was playing guitar in some band. It was kind of like the press gang had arrived. Oh my God, the panic. You'd see Ike Turner's piano player zooming down the stairs. By the end of that first American tour, we thought we'd blown it in America. We'd been consigned to the status of medicine shows and circus freaks with long hair. When we got to Carnegie Hall in New York, we were suddenly back in England with screaming teeny boppers. America was coming around. We realised that it was just starting. Mick and I hadn't come all the way to New York in 1964 not to go to the Apollo. So I hooked up again with Ronnie Bennett. We went to Jones Beach with all the Ronettes in a red Cadillac. The desk rang up. There's a lady downstairs. Come on, let's go. And it was James Brown's week at the Apollo. Maybe Ronnie should describe what nice English boys we were, contrary to popular belief. The first time Keith and Mick came to America, they weren't successful. They slept on my mother's living room floor up in Spanish Harlem. They had no money, and my mom would get up in the morning and make them bacon and eggs. And Keith would always say, "Thank you, Mrs. Bennett." And then I took them to see James Brown at the Apollo. And that's what made them so determined. Those guys went home and they came back superstars. Because I showed them what I did, how I grew up, and how I went to the Apollo Theater when I was 11 years old. I took them backstage and they met all these rhythm and blues stars. I remember Mick standing there shaking when we passed James Brown's room. The first time I went to heaven was when I awoke with Ronnie, later Spector, Bennett, asleep with a smile on her face. We were kids. It doesn't get any better than that. Just more refined. What can I say? She took me to her parents' house, took me to her bedroom. Several times. But that was the first time. And I'm just a guitar player, you know what I mean? James Brown had the whole week there at the Apollo. Go to the Apollo and see James Brown, damn fucking right. I mean, who would turn that down? He was a piece of work. So on the button. We thought we were a tight band. The discipline in the band impressed me more than anything else. On stage, James would snap his fingers if he thought somebody had missed a beat or hit a wrong note. And you could see the player's face fall. He would signal the fine he'd impose with his fingers. These guys would be watching his hands. I even saw Maceo Parker, a sax player who was the architect of James Brown's band, who I finally got to work with in the Winos. Get fined about $50 that night. It was a fantastic show. Mick looking at his foot moves. Mick took more notice than I did that day. Lead singer, dancing, he calls the shots. Backstage that night, James wanted to show off to these English folk. He's got the famous flames and he's sending one out for an hamburger. He's ordering another to polish his shoes and he's humiliating his own band. To me, it was the famous flames and James Brown happened to be the lead singer. But the way he lorded it over his minions, his minders and the actual band, to Mick, was fascinating. When we got back to England, the big difference was seeing old friends, mostly musicians, who were already amazed that we were the Rolling Stones, but now, you've been to the States, man. You were suddenly aware that you'd been distanced just by the fact that you'd been to America. It actually really pissed off the English fans. It happened with the Beatles fans, too. You were no longer theirs. There was a sense of resentment, never more so than in Blackpool. There, at the Empress Ballroom, a few days after our return, we faced the mob again, though this time a rabble army of Scotch drunks baying for blood. They used to have what they called Scotch Week. All the factories in Glasgow shut down, and nearly everybody from there went to Blackpool, the seaside resort. We start the gig, and it's jam-packed. A lot of guys, a lot of them very, very pissed, all dressed up in their Sunday best. And suddenly, while I'm playing, this little red-headed fucker flobs on me. So I move aside, and he follows me and flobs on me again, hits me in the face. So I stand in front of him again, and he spits at me again, and with the stage, his head was just about near my shoe, like a penalty shot in football. I just went bang and knocked his fucking head off with the grace of Beckham. He's never walked the same since. And after that, the riot broke out. They smashed everything, including the piano. We didn't see a piece of equipment that came back any bigger than 3 inches square with wires hanging out. We got out of there by the skin of our teeth. In the days after our return from the US, we appeared on Jukebox Jury, a long-established format presided over by a TV pro called David Jacobs, in which the celebs on the jury discussed the records Jacobs played and then voted them hits or misses. This is one of those landmark moments that completely escaped us while it was happening. But in the media later, it was seen as a declaration of generational war, the cause of outrage, fear and loathing. On the same day, we taped a show called Top of the Pops to promote our Bobby Womack single, It's All Over Now. I'd gotten used to lip-syncing without blushing. That's the way it was done. Very few shows were live. We were getting a little bit cynical about the tripe market. You realised you're really in one of the sleaziest businesses there is, without actually being a gangster. It was a business where the only time people laughed was when they screwed someone else over. I have a feeling that by then we kind of realised the role that we were being cast in, and that there was no fight in it. And anyway, nobody had really played it before, and this would be kind of fun. And we didn't give a shit. Andrew Oldham describes our Jukebox Jury appearance in his book Stoned. With no prompting from me, they proceeded to behave as complete and utter yobbos, and in 25 minutes managed to confirm the nation's worst opinion of them for once and all. They grunted, they laughed among themselves, were merciless towards the drivel that was played, and hostile towards the unflappable Mr. Jacobs. This was no planned press move. Brian and Bill made some effort to be polite, but Mick and Keith and Charlie would have none of it. Nobody was particularly witty or anything. We just trashed every record they played. While the record was playing, we were going, I'm not fit to comment on this. You can't listen to this stuff. Be serious. And there's David Jacobs trying to cover up the dirt. Jacobs was smarmy, but he was actually quite a nice guy. I mean, it had been so easy up till then. Helen Shapiro and Al McCogan, reliable variety club sorts of people. All those showbiz, comfy societies that everybody was roped into. And then we come out of nowhere. I've no doubt that David was thinking, thanks a lot, BBC. I want a raise after working with this lot. It won't get any better. Wait for the Sex Pistols, mate. The Variety Club was like the inner circle at the time in showbiz. You didn't know if it was Freemasons or a charity. It was a clique that basically ran show business. Weirdly archaic English showbiz mafia. We were thrown into all this in order to tear it apart. They were still playing their game. Billy Cotton, Al McCogan. But you realise that all these celebs, and really very few of them were talented, had an incredible swing on things. Who got to play where, who could close doors on you, and who would open them. And luckily, the Beatles had already shown them all what was what. I mean, the writing was on the wall already. So when they had to deal with us, they didn't know quite which way to pussyfoot. The only reason we got a record deal with Decca was because Dick Rowe turned down the Beatles. EMI got them, and he could not afford to make the same mistake twice. Decca was desperate. I'm amazed the guy still had the job. I mean, at the time, just like anything else in popular entertainment, they thought, it's just a fad, it's just a matter of a few haircuts, and we'll tame them anyway. Basically, we only got a record deal because they could not afford to fuck up twice. Otherwise, they wouldn't have touched us with a barge pole. Just out of prejudice. I mean, that whole structure was Variety Club. A nod and a wink here and there. Suppose it served its purpose at the time, no doubt. But suddenly they realised, bang! Welcome to the 20th century. And it's 1964 already. Things happened incredibly fast from the moment Andrew turned up, to me at least. There was a certain feeling that things were running away from us, but you also realise you've just been noosed, honey, and you're going to have to go with it. I was a little bit hesitant to run with it to start with, but Andrew knows it didn't take me long. We were of a very similar mind. Let's figure out how to use Fleet Street. This is partly provoked by an incident at a photo session we did when one of the photographers said to Andrew, "They're so dirty." Andrew's flashpoint was low, and he decided then that from now on, he'd give them what they described. He suddenly saw the beauty of opposites. He'd already done the Beatles stuff with Epstein, so he was a street ahead of me. But he did find a willing partner in me, I must say. Even at that age, there was a chemistry between us. Later, we became firmer friends, but at the time, I looked at him just as Andrew looked at us. I can use these bastards. The media was so easy to manipulate, we could do anything we wanted. We get thrown out of hotels, piss on a garage forecourt. Actually, that was a total accident. Once Bill wants to take a pee, it doesn't stop for about half an hour. Jesus Christ, where does little bloke put all that? We went to the Grand Hotel in Bristol deliberately to get thrown out. Andrew called Fleet Street to say, if you want to watch the Stones get thrown out of the Grand Hotel, be there at such and such a time, because we were dressed incorrectly. The way Andrew could set them up, we'd have them panting for nothing. And of course it provoked things like, would you let your daughter marry one? Well, I don't know whether Andrew planted that idea on somebody or whether it was just one of those lunchtime oboes ideas. We were obnoxious, but these people were so complacent, they didn't know what hit them. It was blitzkrieg, really, an assault on the whole PR setup. And suddenly, you realise there's this landscape out there, these people that need to be told what to do. While we were pulling all these stunts, Andrew was going round in a Chevrolet Impala driven by Reg, his butch gay chauffeur from Stepney. Reg was a very nasty piece of work. In those days, it was a miracle to get four lines from a rock journalist at New Musical Express. But it was important because there was very little radio, not much TV. There was a writer at the Record Mirror called Richard Green who had used that precious space to write about my complexion. I didn't even suffer from the blemishes he described, but this was the last straw for Andrew. He took Reg and he barged into the writer's office. And with Reg holding his hands under the open window, he said to Richard, I quote again from Andrew's memoir, "Richard, I got a call this morning from a very hurt and upset Mrs. Richards. Now, you don't know her, but she's Keith Richards' mum. She said, 'Mr. Oldham, can you do anything to stop what this man keeps saying about my boy's acne? I know you can't stop that rubbish about how they don't wash, but Keith is a sensitive boy, even if he doesn't say so. Please, Mr. Oldham, can you do anything?' So, Richard, this is the story. If you ever again write something about Keith that is out of line, that is hurtful to his mum, because I'm responsible to Keith's mum, your hands will be where they are now, but with one big difference. Reg here will bring that fucking window crashing down on your ugly hands, and you will not be writing, you malicious fat turd, for a long fucking time, and you won't be dictating either, because your jaw will be sewn up from where Reg fucking broke it." And with that, as it goes, they made their excuses and left. I didn't even realise until I read his book that Andrew was still living with his mother while he was pulling off all this daring do. Maybe that had something to do with it. He was smarter and sharper than the arseholes that were running the media, or the people running the record companies, who were totally out of touch with what was happening. You could just run in and rob the whole bank. It was a bit Clockwork Orange. There was no great universal, "We want to change society." We just knew that things were changing and that they could be changed. They were just too comfortable. It was all too satisfied. And we thought, how can we run rampant? Of course, all of us ran into the brick wall of the establishment. It was an impetus that couldn't be stopped. It was like when somebody says something and you've got the most fantastic reply, you know you really shouldn't say it, but it has to be said. Even though you know it's going to get you in shit, it's too good a line not to say. You'd feel that you chickened out on yourself if you didn't say it. Oldham modelled himself to an extent on his idol Phil Spector as a producer as well as a manager. But unlike Spector, he wasn't a natural in the studio. I doubt whether Andrew would call me a liar when I say he was not very musical. He knew what he liked and what other people liked. But if you said E7th to him, you might as well be saying, "What's the meaning of life?" To me, a producer is somebody that at the end of the day comes out with everybody going, "Yeah, we got it." Andrew's musical input was minimal, and it was usually saved for backup vocals, la 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 here, okay, we'll throw someone. He'd never gotten away the way we did things, whether he agreed with it or not. But as a fully fledged producer with knowledge of recording and knowledge of music, he was on weaker ground. He had good taste for the market, especially once we went to America. The minute we got to America, it took the scales from his eyes as to what we were about, and more he let us just get on with it. And basically, that was the genius, I think, of Andrew's method of producing, to let us make the records. and to provide a lot of energy and enthusiasm. When you've got to take 30 and you're starting to flag a bit, you need that encouragement thing. Just one more take. Come on. Unflagging enthusiasm. We've got it. We're nearly there. When I was growing up, the idea of leaving England was pretty much remote. My dad did it once, but that was in the army to go to Normandy and get his leg blown off. The idea was totally impossible. You just read about other countries and looked at them on TV and in National Geographic. The black chicks with their tits hanging out and their long necks. But you never expected to see it. Scraping up the money to get out of England would have been way beyond my capabilities. One of the first places I remember us going to, after the USA, was Belgium. And even that was an adventure. It was like going to Tibet, and the Olympia, and Paris. And then suddenly you're in Australia, and you're actually seeing the world. And they're paying you. But my God, there are some black holes. Dunedin, for instance, almost the southernmost city in the world in New Zealand. It looked like Tombstone and it felt like it. It still had hitching rails. It was Sunday, a wet, dark Sunday in Dunedin in 1965. I don't think you could have found anything more depressing anywhere. The longest day of my life. It seemed to go on forever. We were usually pretty good at entertaining ourselves, but Dunedin made Aberdeen seem like Las Vegas. Very rarely did everybody get depressed at the same time. There's usually one to support the others, but in Dunedin, everybody was totally depressed. No chance of any redemption or laughter, even the drink didn't get you pissed. On Sunday, there'd be little knocks on the door, church in 10 minutes. It was just one of those miserable grey days that took me back to my childhood, I suppose. A day that will never end. A gloom. And not anything on the horizon. Boredom is an illness to me, and I don't suffer from it. But that moment was the lowest ebb. I think I'll stand on my head, try and recycle the drugs. But Roy Orbison... It was only because we were with Roy Orbison that we were there at all. He was definitely top of the bill that night. What a beacon in the southernmost gloom. The amazing Roy Orbison. He was one of those Texan guys who could sail through anything, including his whole tragic life. His kids die in a fire. His wife dies in a car crash. Nothing in his private life went right for the big O. But I cannot think of a gentler gentleman or a more stoic personality. That incredible talent for blowing himself up from 5'6" to 6'9", which he seemed to be able to do on stage. It was amazing to witness. He's been in the sun, looking like a lobster, pair of shorts on, and we're just sitting around playing guitars, having a chat, smoke and a drink. Well, I'm on in 5 minutes. We watch the opening number, and out walks this totally transformed thing that seems to have grown at least a foot with presence and command over the crowd. He was in his shorts just now. How did he do that? It's one of those astounding things about working in the theatre. Backstage, you can be a bunch of bums. And ladies and gentlemen, or... I present to you, and you're somebody else. Mick and I spent months and months trying to write before we had anything we could record for the Stones. We wrote some terrible songs, whose titles included We Were Falling in Love and So Much in Love, not to mention Walking Through the Sleepy City, which is a rip-off of He's a Rebel. Some of them were actually medium-sized hits. Gene Pitney, for example, singing That Girl Belongs to Yesterday, although he improved on the words and on our original title, which was my only girl. I wrote a forgotten gem called All I Want Is My Baby, which was recorded by PJ Proby's valet, Bobby Jameson. I wrote Surprise, Surprise, recorded by Lulu. We ended Cliff Richard's run of hits when he recorded our Blue Turns to Grey. It was one of the rare times one of his records went to the top 30 instead of the top 10. And when the Searchers did Take It or Leave It, it torpedoed them as well. Our songwriting had this other function of hobbling the opposition while we got paid for it. It had the opposite effect on Marion Faithfull. It made her into a star with As Tears Go By. The title changed by Andrew Oldham from the Casablanca song As Time Goes By, written on a 12-string guitar. We thought, what a terrible piece of tripe. We came out and played it to Andrew and he said, it's a hit. We actually sold this stuff and it actually made money. Mick and I were thinking, this is money for old rope. Mick and I knew by now that really our job was to write songs for the Stones. It took us 8-9 months before we came up with The Last Time, which is the first one that we felt we could give to the rest of the guys without being sent out of the room. If I'd gone to the Rolling Stones with As Tears Go By, it would have been get out and don't come back. Mick and I were trying to hone it down. We kept coming up with these ballads, nothing to do with what we were doing. And then finally we came up with The Last Time, and we looked at each other and said, let's try this one with the boys. The song has the first recognisable Stones riff or guitar figure on it. The chorus is from the Staple Singers version, This May Be The Last Time. We could work this hook. Now we had to find a verse. It had a Stones twist to it, one that maybe could have been written earlier, a song about going on the road and dumping some chick. You don't try very hard to please me. Not the usual serenade to the unattainable object of desire. And that was when it really clicked, with that song, when Mick and I felt confident enough to actually lay it in front of Brian and Charlie and Ian Stewart, especially arbiter of events. With those earlier songs, we would have been chased out of the room. But that song defined us in a way, and it went to number one in the UK. Andrew created an amazing thing in my life. I'd never thought about songwriting. He made me learn the craft, and at the same time I realised, yeah, I am good at it. And slowly, this whole other world opens up, because now you're not just a player or trying to play like somebody else. It isn't just other people's expression. I can start to express myself. I can write my own music. It's almost like a bolt of lightning. The Last Time was recorded during a magical period at the RCA Studios in Hollywood. We recorded there intermittently across 2 years between June 1964 and August 1966, which culminated in the album Aftermath. All of his songs were penned by Mick and me, the Glimmer Twins, as we later called ourselves. It was the period where everything, songwriting, recording, performing, stepped into a new league, and the time where Brian started going off the rails. The work was always intensely hard. The gig never finished just because you got off the stage. We had to go back to the hotel and start honing down these songs. We'd come off the road and we had 4 days to cut the tracks for an album, a week maximum. A track would get 30 to 40 minutes to get down. It wasn't that difficult because we're on the road, the band's well oiled. We got 10, 15 songs, but it was non-stop, high-pressure work, which is probably good for us. When we recorded The Last Time in January 1965, we'd come back off the road, and everyone's exhausted. We'd gone in to record the single only. After we finished the last time, the only stones left standing were me and Mick. Phil Spector was there. Andrew had asked him to come down and listen to the track, and so was Jack Nietzsche. A janitor had come to clean up. This silence sweeping in the corner of this huge studio, while this remaining group picked up instruments. Spector picked up Bill Wyman's bass. Nietzsche went to the harpsichord. And the B-side, Play With Fire, was cut with half the Rolling Stones and this unique lineup. When we first arrived in Los Angeles on that second tour, it was Sonny Bono who was sent to meet us at the airport with a car because he was the promotion man for Phil Spector then. A year later, Sonny and Cher were being feted at the Dorchester, presented to the world by Ahmet Ertegun. But back then, when he knew we were looking for a studio, Sonny put us in touch with Jack Nietzsche, and RCA was the first place he suggested. Well, we went more or less straight there, into the limo and pool world, from a three-day tour of Ireland, in almost surreal contrast in cultures. Jack was in and out of the studio, more to get relief from Phil Spector and the enormous amount of work required to make the wall of sound than anything else. Jack was the genius, not Phil. Rather, Phil took on Jack's eccentric persona and sucked his insides out. But Jack Nietzsche was an almost silent and unpaid for reasons still not clear, except he did it for fun. Arranger, musician, gluer together of the talent, a man of enormous importance for us in that period. He came to our sessions to relax and would throw in some ideas. He'd play when the mood took him. He's on Let's Spend the Night Together when he took over my piano part while I took over bass. This is just one example of his input. I loved the man. Somehow, we still had no money, even by late 1964. Our first album, The Rolling Stones, was top of the charts, sold 100,000 copies, which is more than the Beatles initially sold. So where was the money? In fact, we simply figured that if we broke even, we were cool. But we also knew we weren't tapping a huge market that we had opened. The system was that you didn't get money from English sales until a year after the record came out, 18 months later if it was for foreign sales. There was no money in any of the American tours. Everyone was rooming with everybody. Oldham used to sleep on Phil Spector's couch. We did the TAMI show in America, late 1964. The show where we came on after James Brown to get us back home. We earned $25,000. So did Cherry and the Pacemakers and Billy J. Kramer and the Dakotas. That's a bit much, isn't it? The first real cash I ever saw came from selling As Tears Go By. I certainly remember the first time I got it. I looked at it, and then I counted it, and then I looked at it again, and then I felt it and touched it. I did nothing with it. I just kept it in my bin, saying, I've got such a lot of money, shit! I didn't particularly want to buy anything or blow it. For the first time in my life, I got money. Maybe I'll buy a new shirt, spring for some guitar strings. But basically it was, I don't believe this shit. There's the Queen's face all over it, and it's signed by the right man, and you've got more than you've ever had in your hand ever, and more than your dad makes in a year, schlepping and working his fucking ass off. I mean, what to do with it is another thing, because I've got another gig to do and I'm working. But I must say, the first taste of a few hundred crisp new bills was not unsatisfying. What to do with it took some time, but it was the first feeling of being ahead of the game. And all I did was write a couple of songs and they gave it to me. One big setback we had was not being paid by Robert Stigwood for a tour we did with one of his acts. If the homework had been done, we would have known that this was his modus operandi. Late paying turned into not paying at all, and we had to go all the way to the High Court. But before that, alas for him, one night at a club called the Scotch of St. James, he made the terrible mistake of coming down the stairs as Andrew and I were going up. We blocked off the staircase so I could extract payment. You can't use a boot on a winding staircase, so he got the knee. One for every grand he owed us, 16 of them. Even then he never apologised. Maybe I didn't kick him hard enough. And when I got some more money, I took care of Mum. They'd split up, Doris and Bert, a year after I left home. Dad's dad, but I bought Mum a house. I was always in touch with Doris. But that implied I couldn't be in touch with Bert because they'd split up. It was like I couldn't take sides. And also I didn't have much time for that because life was getting really exciting. I'm zooming all over the place. I've got other things to do. What Mum and Dad were doing was not at the forefront of my mind. Then came Satisfaction, the track that launched us into global fame. I was between girlfriends at the time, in my flat in Carlton Hill, St. John's Wood. Hence maybe the mood of the song. I wrote Satisfaction in my sleep. I had no idea I'd written it. It's only thank God for the little Philips cassette player. The miracle being that I looked at a cassette player that morning and I knew I put a brand new tape in the previous night and I saw it was at the end. Then I pushed rewind and there was Satisfaction. It was just a rough idea. It was just the bare bones of the song and it didn't have that noise, of course, because I was on acoustic, and 40 minutes of me snoring. The bare bones is all you need. I had that cassette for a while. I wish I kept it. Mick wrote the lyrics by the pool in Clearwater, Florida, 4 days before we went into the studio and recorded it. First at Chess in Chicago, an acoustic version, and later with the Fuzz Tone at RCA in Hollywood. I wasn't exaggerating when I wrote a postcard home from Clearwater that said, "Hi, Mum, working like a dog, same as ever. Love, Keith." It was really down to one little foot pedal, the Gibson Fuzz Tone, a little box they put out at that time. I've only ever used foot pedals twice. The other time was for Some Girls in the late 70s, when I used an XR box with a nice hillbilly Sun Records slap echo on it. But effects are not my thing. I just go for quality of sound. Do I want this sharp and hard and cutting, or do I want warm, smooth, Beast of Burden stuff? Basically, you go Fender or Gibson. In Satisfaction, I was imagining horns, trying to imitate their sound to put on the track later when we recorded. I'd already heard the riff in my head, the way Otis Redding did it later, thinking, this is going to be the horn line. But we didn't have any horns, and I was only going to lay down the dub. The Fuzz Tone came in handy so I could give a shape to what the horns were supposed to do. But a Fuzz Tone had never been heard before anywhere. And that's the sound that caught everybody's imagination. Next thing I know, we're listening to ourselves in Minnesota, somewhere on the radio. Hit of the week. And we didn't even know Andrew put the fucking thing out. At first, I was mortified. As far as I was concerned, that was just the dub. 10 days on the road, and it's number one nationally. The record of the summer of 65. So I'm not arguing. And I learned that lesson. Sometimes you can overwork things. Not everything is designed for your taste and your taste alone. Satisfaction was a typical collaboration between Mick and me at the time. I would say, on a general scale, I would come up with a song and the basic idea, and Mick would do all the hard work of filling it in and making it interesting. I would come up with, I can't get no satisfaction. I can't get no satisfaction. I tried and I tried and I tried and I tried, but I can't get no satisfaction. And then we put ourselves together and Mick would come back and say, hey, when I'm riding in my car and same cigarettes as me, and then we'd tinker about with that. In those years, that was basically the setup. Hey, you, get off my cloud. Hey, you, would be my contribution. Paint it black. I wrote the melody, he wrote the lyrics. It's not that you can say in one phrase, he wrote that and he did that, but the musical riff is mostly coming from me. I'm the riff master. The only one I missed and that Mick Jagger got was Brown Sugar. And I will tip my hat there. There he got me. I mean, I did tidy it up a bit, but that was his words and music. A peculiarity of Satisfaction is that it's a hell of a song to play on stage. For years and years, we never played it, or very rarely, until maybe the past 10 or 15 years. Couldn't get the sound right. Didn't feel right. Just sounded weedy. It took the band a long time to figure out how to play Satisfaction on stage. What made us like it was when Otis Redding covered it. With that, and Aretha Franklin's version, which Jerry Wexler produced, we heard what we'd tried to write in the first place. We liked it and started playing it because the very best of soul music was singing our song. In 1965, Oldham bumped into Alan Klein, the pipe-smoking, smooth-talking manager. And I still think it was the best move Oldham made to put us together with him. Andrew loved the idea that Klein had put to him that no contract is worth the paper it's written on, which we later found out to be painfully true in our relations with Alan Klein himself. My attitude at the time was that Eric Easton, Andrew's partner and our agent, was just too tired. In fact, he was ill. Onward. Whatever happened later with Alan Klein, he was brilliant at generating cash. And he was also spectacular at first in blasting through the record companies and tour managers who'd been overpaying themselves and being inattentive to business. One of the first things Klein did was to renegotiate the contract between the Rolling Stones and Decca Records. And so one day, we walked into the Decca office. A stage-managed piece of theatre by Klein. The most obvious crass ploy. We got our instructions. We're going into Decca today, and we're going to work on these motherfuckers. We're going to make a deal, and we're going to come out with the best record contract ever. Wear some shades and don't say a thing, said Klein. Just troop in and stand at the back of the room and look at these old doddering farts. Don't talk. I'll do the talking. We were just there as intimidation, basically. And it worked. Sir Edward Lewis, the chairman of Decca, was behind the desk, and Sir Edward was actually drooling. I mean, not over us. He was just drooling. And then somebody would come along and pat him with a handkerchief. He was on his last legs, let's face it. We just stood there with shades on. It was really the old guard and the new. They crumbled and we walked out of there with a deal bigger than the Beatles. And this is where you got to take your hat off to Alan. These five hoodlums then went back with Alan to the Hilton and glugged down the champagne and congratulated ourselves on our performance. And Sir Edward Lewis, he might have been drooling and everything, but he wasn't stupid. he made a lot of money off of that deal himself. It was an incredibly successful deal for both parties, which is what a deal is supposed to be. I mean, I'm still getting paid off of it. It's called the Decca Balloon. With us, Klein was very much Colonel Tom Parker with Elvis. Aye, I'll make the deals. Anything you want, just ask me, you got it. Patrician in his dealings with us, and with money. You could always get some from him. If you wanted a gold-plated Cadillac, he'd give it to you. When I rang and asked him for £80,000 to buy a house on Chelsea Embankment near the Mick so we could wander back and forth and write songs, it came the next day. You just didn't know the half of it. It was a paternalistic form of management that obviously doesn't rub anymore these days, but it was still flying then. It was a different state of mind to now, where every fucking guitar pick is paid for and accounted for. It was rock and roll. Klein was magnificent at first in the States. The next tour under his management was cranked up several gears. A private plane to get us about, huge billboards on Sunset Boulevard. Now we're talking. One hit requires another very quickly, or you fast start to lose altitude. At that time, you were expected to churn them out. Satisfaction is suddenly number one all over the world. Mick and I are looking at each other saying, this is nice. Then bang, bang, bang at the door. Where's the follow-up? We need it in 4 weeks. And we're on the road doing 2 shows a day. You needed a new single every 2 months. You had to have another one all ready to shoot. And you needed a new sound. If we'd come along with another fuzz riff after Satisfaction, we'd have been dead in the water, repeating with the law of diminishing returns. Many a band has faltered and foundered on that rock. Get Off of My Cloud was a reaction to the record company's demands for more. Leave me alone. And it was an attack from another direction, and it flew as well. So now, we're the Song Factory. We start to think like songwriters, and once you get that habit, it stays with you all your life. It motors along in your subconscious in the way you listen. Our songs were taking on some kind of edge in the lyrics, or at least they were beginning to sound like the image projected onto us. Cynical, nasty, skeptical, rude. We seemed to be ahead in this respect at the time. It was trouble in America. All these young American kids, they were being drafted to Vietnam. Which is why you have Satisfaction in Apocalypse Now. Because the Nutters took us with them. The lyrics and the mood of the songs fitted with the kids' disenchantment with the grown-up world of America. And for a while, we seemed to be the only provider, the soundtrack for the rumbling of rebellion, touching on those social nerves. I wouldn't say we were the first, but a lot of that mood had an English idiom through our songs, despite their being highly American influenced. We was taking the piss in the old English tradition. This wave of recording and songwriting culminated in the album Aftermath. And many of the songs we wrote around this time had what you might call anti-girl lyrics. Anti-girl titles too. Stupid Girl, Under My Thumb, Out of Time, That Girl Belongs to Yesterday, Yesterday's Papers. Who wants Yesterday's Girl? Nobody in the world. Maybe we were winding them up. And maybe some of the songs open up their hearts a little, or their minds, to the idea of, we're women, we're strong. But I think the Beatles and the Stones, particularly, did release chicks from the fact of, I'm just a little chick. It was not intentional or anything. It just became obvious as you were playing to them. When you got 3,000 chicks in front of you that are ripping off their panties and throwing them at you, you realise what an awesome power you have unleashed. Everything they've been brought up not to do, they could do at a rock and roll show. And the songs, well, they also came from a lot of frustration from our point of view. You go on the road for a month, you come back, and she's with somebody else. Look at that stupid girl. It's a two-way street. I know, too, that I was making unfavourable comparisons between the chicks at home who were driving us mad and the girls we fell in with on the tours who seemed so much less demanding. With English chicks, it was, you're putting a make on her or she's putting a make on you. Yay or nay. I always found with black chicks, that wasn't the main issue. It was just comfortable, and if shit happened later, okay. It was just part of life. They were great because they were chicks, but they were much more like guys than English girls were. You didn't mind them being around after the event. I mean, I remember being in the Ambassador Hotel with this black chick called Flo, who was my piece at the time. She'd take care of me. Love? No. Respect? Yeah. I'd always remember, because we'd laugh when we heard the Supremes singing, Flo, she doesn't know, lying on the bed. And it always made us giggle. Yeah, you take a little bit out of this one experience, and then a week later, you're down the road. There was certainly that conscious element in those RCA days from the end of 65 to summer of 66 of pushing the envelope in milder ways. There was Paint It Black, for example, recorded in March 1966, our sixth British number one. Brian Jones, now transformed into a multi-instrumentalist, having given up playing the guitar, played sitar. It was a different style to everything I'd done before. Maybe it was the Jew in me. It's more to me like having a gila or some gypsy lick. Maybe I picked it up for my granddad. It's definitely on a different curve to everything else. I've moved around the world a bit. I was no longer strictly a Chicago blues man. I had to spread the wings a bit to come up with melodies and ideas. Although I can't say that we ever played Tel Aviv or Romania. But you start to latch on to different things. With songwriting, it's a constant experiment. I've never done it consciously, like saying, oh, I've got to explore such and such a thing. We were learning about making the album the centre of attention, the form for the music, instead of just singles. Making an LP usually consisted of having two or three single hits and their B-sides, and then filler. Everything was 2 minutes, 29 seconds for a single. Otherwise, you wouldn't get played on the radio. I talked to Paul McCartney about this recently. We changed it. Every track was a potential single. There was no filler. And if there was, it was an experiment. We'd use the extended time we had with an album just to make more of a statement. If LPs hadn't existed, probably the Beatles and ourselves wouldn't have lasted more than 2.5 years. You had to keep condensing, reducing what it was you wanted to say to please the distributor. Otherwise, radio stations wouldn't play it. Dylan's Visions of Joanna was the breakthrough. Going Home was 11 minutes long. It ain't gonna be a single. Can you extend and expand the product? Can it be done? And that was really the main experiment. We said, you can't edit this shit. It either goes out like it is, or you're done with it. I've no doubt Dylan felt the same about Sad-Eyed Lady of the Lowlands or Visions of Johanna. The record got bigger. And could anybody listen to that much? It's over 3 minutes. Can you keep their attention? Can you keep your audience? But it worked. The Beatles and ourselves probably made the album the vehicle for recording and hastened the demise of the single. It didn't go away immediately. You always needed a hit single. It just extended you without your even really knowing it. And because you've been playing every day, sometimes two or three shows a day, ideas are flowing. One thing feeds the other. You might be having a swim or screwing the old lady, but somewhere in the back of your mind, you're thinking about this chord sequence or something related to a song. No matter what the hell's going on, you might be getting shot at, and you'll still be, ah, that's the bridge, and there's nothing you can do. You don't realise it's happening. It's totally subconscious, unconscious, or whatever. The radar is on, whether you know it or not. You cannot switch it off. You hear this piece of conversation from across the room. I just can't stand you anymore. That's a song. It just flows in. And also, the other thing about being a songwriter, when you realise you are one, is that to provide ammo, you start to become an observer. You start to distance yourself. You're constantly on the alert. That faculty gets trained in you over the years, observing people, how they react to one another, which in a way makes you weirdly distant. You shouldn't really be doing it. It's a little bit of peeping Tom to be a songwriter. You start looking round and everything's a subject for a song. The banal phrase, which is the one that makes it. And you say, I can't believe nobody hooked up on that one before. Luckily, there are more phrases than songwriters, just about. Linda Keith was the one that first broke my heart. It was my fault. I asked for it and I got it. Her first look was the deepest. Watching her, with all her tricks and movements, fearfully, from across the room and feeling that hit of longing and thinking, she's out of my league. I was sometimes in awe of the women I was with at the start because, I mean, they were the creme de la creme and I'd come from the gutter as far as I was concerned. I didn't believe these beautiful women wanted to say hello, let alone lie down with me. Linda and I met at a party given by Andrew Oldham, a party of some forgotten Jagger Richards written single. It was the party where Mick first met Marion Faithfull. Linda was 17, strikingly beautiful, very dark hair, the perfect look for the 60s, a blinder, very self-assured in her jeans and a white shirt. She was in a magazine, she was modelling. David Bailey was photographing her. Not that she was particularly interested. The girl just wanted something to do to get out of the house. When I first met Linda, I was just astounded that she wanted to come along with me. Once again, the girl puts the make on me. She bedded me. I didn't bed her. She made a line straight for me, and I was totally, absolutely in love. We fell for each other. And the other surprise was that I was Linda's first love, the first boy she ever fell for. She'd been actively pursued by all kinds of people who she'd rejected. To this day, I don't understand it. Linda was the best friend of Andrew Oldham's then almost wife, Sheila Klein. These beautiful Jewish girls were a powerful cultural force in West Hampstead, Bohemia, which became my stomping ground and mixed too for a couple of years. It centred around Broadhurst Gardens, West Hampstead, near where Decca Records was situated, and a few venues around there where we played. Linda's father was Alan Keith, who for 44 years presented a programme on BBC Radio called Your 100 Best Tunes. Linda had been